I'm Eric Allen for KLCC. Tales from the Forgotten Kingdom is a performance by the Guy Mendelow Ensemble, including music and story that reach into the history of Sephardic Jews and the Ladino language, a Judeo-Spanish language that blends archaic Spanish with Arabic, Turkish, and Greek. The Guy Mendelow Ensemble will perform at the Jaqua Concert Hall of the Shedd Institute in Eugene on Sunday, October 9th, as well as giving a public talk at the UO on Monday, October 10th. Thanks for your time today, Guy.
It's great to be here with you. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, the origins of Sephardic music and culture in the Iberian Peninsula are not well known to many. Can you talk briefly about the cultural roots of this performance?
Sure. And, you know, before I say that, it's there's a good reason that it's not well known, and that has a lot to do with the Second World War and what happened to these communities ultimately. But, to boil down a long, long history, when we're talking about Sephardic music, what we're really talking about is the music of the Jews that were expelled from the Iberian Peninsula in 1492. This is the same king and queen who sent Columbus out to discover a continent on which people had been living for 40 or 50,000 years. And they altered the course of European history when they expelled not just the Jews, but also the Muslims. And the Jews were welcomed by the sultans of the Ottoman Empire. You could call that, in a way, the second great global empire on this planet. And they settled huge swath of land from stretching from North Africa and into the Balkans. The language that we're talking about here, Ladino, came about in these communities. You know, when they left the south of Spain, the Jews spoke the same Spanish as Ferdinand and Isabella and Columbus. But when they left, the door shut behind them forcefully, and what that means is that the river of language in Spain evolved in different ways than the river of language in each of these communities, which is in a way why this language is a bit of a ghost language, because the pronunciations of 500 years ago, some of the lexicon, some of the grammar, some of the ways of spelling were frozen in time. And this language evolved, like you said, towards whatever was happening on the ground. So it picked up, you know, bits of Greek or Turkish or Arabic, depending on where the community is. But if you want to have a good shot of understanding what Christopher Columbus may have sounded like, this may be the best living example.
You mentioned that the horrors of World War II had a serious impact on why this is indeed a forgotten kingdom. What would you like to say about that?
You know, when we think about history of immigrants in different countries, we often focus on history of exclusion and history of isolation. You know, this idea of wanting to preserve your identity. And we have this kind of idea, this myth, really, about some of these communities, about, you know, living in the Ottoman Empire, but not really wanting to participate, not serving in the army, getting out of it whenever you can. And one thing that is unique and that is worth knowing about these communities is that these were models of integration. In other words, for example, the Jews of Salonika saw themselves as indigenous. And in 1892, when they celebrated the 400th anniversary, it wasn't the anniversary of the expulsion. It was the anniversary of their inclusion into Salonika and basically becoming native. To themselves, in a language that no one from the outside would read, they would boast about just how Ottoman and later just how Greek they actually were, and took pride in serving in the military and really saw themselves as part of the lifeblood of this community. And this happened time and time again. You know, the same is true in Sarajevo, which is why what ultimately happened was such a betrayal and such a heartache, because they saw themselves as legitimate citizens. In fact, in Salonika, the city was over half Jewish. You know, in the turn of the 20th century, you had a city that had 90,000 Jews in a city that was about 170,000, so more than 50%. And to give an example that your listeners will be familiar with, you know, we talk about the concept of decimation. That's a Roman term where one out of every 10 Roman soldiers would be killed by their own army, to set an example. In these communities, you had decimation times 9. Today in Salonika, you have a population of Jews numbering about 1,000 in a city of 1,000,000. That's 96% population reduction. And this happens in community after community, not in all communities, but in so many, which is one of the reasons that if you walk up to most Americans and say, "So, did you hear about the Spanish-speaking Jews of Greece?" It's a joke at best. We don't know And as fascinated as we are with World War II, these stories of struggle and these stories of bravery are often left out.
And so many of the powerful aspects of history are what it means for us in the present day in our own place. So what are the lessons of these difficulties that you think we need to really remember in America in 2016?
Oh, you know, Ladino music, Ladino culture in general, is such a wonderful case study of, I think, stories that are universal. You know, who doesn't know what it's like to leave one home and come to another? You know, as immigrants to this country, most of us in the ensemble, we live this story, and so do many people. You know, what is it like to watch yourself change or not even notice that you change until you go back home and realize just how different you are? What is it like for a community to change because you're there? You know, this is the American story, isn't it? But when we talk about music, this idea of shifting borders and adaptation and, you know, this kind of epic game of telephone where songs are passed down and change and passed down and change. I mean, isn't that really the story of just about every music? Here we just have a really distinct case study of something that we are all living.
What was it about this music that you fell in love with as a child in Israel?
Oh, boy. Actually, as a child in Israel, I did not fall in love with it. You know, you hear this music, and first of all, I have to say that this is a true folk music. The songs that we're singing on stage were not meant for the stage, and they were not meant for commercial recordings. These were songs that, first of all, they were all women that were singing, and they were sung without any accompaniment. And they were sung in the home or in, you know, weddings or funerals or that kind of thing. And when you listen to them, it can be pretty foreign if you don't know what the language is, if you don't know what the stories are, if you don't know what the music is. So I listened to them as a child and I thought, good heavens, what is that? You know, wafting out the window in the streets of Jerusalem. I needed to grow up a lot. I needed to learn Spanish fluently in order to begin to understand what I was listening to. But once I understood, you know, look, for anybody who likes Tolkien, for anybody who is fascinated by Game of Thrones, this is the stuff, you know. Tolkien looked at some of these romanzas, some of the epic ballads. He looked at many things, but this was certainly part of what he was looking at when he was thinking about Middle Earth. And for anybody who loves stories of kings and queens and, you know, nice things like murder and extortion and beheadings and kidnapping and, you know, along with totally raucous and bawdy tales, I mean, this is all right there. And so I was grabbed by the stories, but I was also grabbed by the melodies, you know, and when you have these melodies that twist and twine between mode and meter, and it's just fascinating. And then the history, you know, and I thought this was going to be a 2-year project for me. And man, I went right down the rabbit hole.
So how do you find the balance between curation of those songs and creation of your own music and bringing the ancient songs into the modern day and the particular ensemble you have?
Yeah, great question. First of all, I should clarify, there is this kind of myth for those who do know about Sephardic music that these songs are ancient, and they're not. These songs are relatively new, and you know, when we're talking about Ladino song, new is, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s. Some of the legends are actually ancient. Some of the lyrics are actually ancient, but we have no way of knowing what songs would have sounded like or what melodies were used. This music was not written down until early in the 1900s. And even after it was written down, this is a game of telephone more than anything. Things change. And this music has a history of adaptation, as do the lyrics and the stories. So ancient, they're not. But the question between, you know, about how do you present these songs in a way that is authentic is an interesting one. And you know, anybody who works with traditional material, and I don't care where in the world it's from, any creative artist tangling with it has a big responsibility and a lot of questions to answer. And we all kind of situate ourselves along a spectrum between cultural curation and artistic creation. And for this project, early on, I knew that although there is the academic in me, you can probably hear that in the way I talk, I wanted to tell these stories in a way that would be visceral for an audience today. I wanted it to be as cinematographic as possible. I wanted people to be swept away in stories. And so that meant First of all, that I was going to sing women's songs with instrumentation. And not only that, I was going to cast it in my own way. Because I know that if people are going to care about these cultures, they're going to care because they got swept up in an emotionally riveting experience first. You know, people don't come for a lecture. People come for you know, to be whisked away to long-lost times and places. So that's what I wanted. And so we tell these stories. I looked for musicians who could tell these stories and bring out qualities that are not part of what you would have heard in 1920 in Salonika. You know, our singer comes from Argentina. She is an expert in tango. And I wanted that because that way of storytelling, that passionate fire, is exactly what I wanted to insert. That's not part of the music originally. Our percussionist is from Palestine. You know, his expertise is in Arabic percussion, but he is also kind of a world general player, and I wanted that. Our violinist is a film scorer, and he is an expert at bringing, you know, all this kind of atmospheric nuance to the music and using his violin a bit like a chameleon. And these are the things that I wanted because I wanted an audience to just to be captivated by amazing stories. And these are good stories. It doesn't matter that they're Jewish. It doesn't matter that they're Greek or Ottoman. They're good stories because they're good stories. And that's part of the reason that they've endured so long.
You mentioned authenticity in presentation. And to me, there's another aspect of authenticity, which is authentic to your own soul and your own musical presentation. So that must figure in your creation as well as the curation.
Definitely. But I would say also that the whole question of authenticity is an interesting one, you know, because what's authentic? I mean, is authentic the way it was sung in Salonika in 1920? Or how about 1921? How about when the foxtrot or, you know, the Charleston swept through and that was the rage and people started singing these songs like a Charleston? Was that authentic? You know, it gets into murky territories. But one thing you can definitely say is that anytime you have an artist who is tangling with traditions that are beyond their own lived upbringing, they're always going to substitute their own background for the cultural identity markers. And I'm talking about the timbre, the voice, and things like that. So, you know, what we're not doing is singing these songs in the way that they would have been heard in these communities around this time. We're singing it in a way that feels authentic to us and I hope to an audience.
How do you merge those stories with the songs on stage? What might people expect when they come to the performance at the Shed?
So Tales from the Forgotten Kingdom is a kind of a long-form show. These are individual stories and they're fantastic, but what we've done is woven them into one large story that begins at the beginning and weaves through to the end. It's a little bit like what Judy Taymor did with the Beatles when she created the film Across the Universe, and she took different songs and kind of stitched them together to make one long story. And, you know, these are stories of soldiers riding into battle. These are stories of queens who give up everything because it's more just. These are stories about, you know, decorated war heroes who feel betrayed by nations that are moving further into nationalism and wind up commandeering a ship and taking it out, you know, in the dead of night. It's about the early days of radio. And these are stories about, you know, hipsters who feel like they're going to get the girl and they wind up getting thrown down a well. And, you know, all kinds of kind of raucous body stuff like that. And I think that audiences can expect to be whisked away to some picturesque places and some long ago times.
And it also sounds like some of those stories could translate, for better or worse, into the modern day with ease.
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the things that about these stories. You know, one of the reasons that stories like this endure is exactly because of that. You know, you don't need to know anything about Ladino music to enjoy these stories and to be kept up in them. And most audiences don't know anything about Ladino music. You know, they know a good story when they hear it, and this repertoire is full of it.
What in the end do you wish the audience to feel or gain from having experienced the performance or your talk?
You know, first of all, I want them to be swept up. You know, it's about emotional resonance. I think that when we have a heart connection, when we connect with good stories, we almost inadvertently want to also learn more. And so I'm well aware that most audiences in the United States or North America, you know, don't know, maybe don't care about these cultures before they come. They come for the stories. I think that when you're swept up in something like this, and when you really resonate with these characters and with these situations, that you leave with a spark of fascination to learn more. You know, it's just like The Revenant. I didn't know anything about Montana before I saw The Revenant. I'm speaking to you from Montana, which is why I'm thinking about this. You know, but that movie was so powerful, and I got so caught up in it that immediately I went and read so much about Montana, you know? And it's because that's what happens when we, you know, we live our lives as in stories, right? And when we connect with a really good story, I think the natural reaction is you want to learn more. And that's not from the head, that's from the heart, and that's my hope.
Yes, music is the only way that I know to learn history in a way that makes you want to dance.
That's right. Yeah. Or commandeer a ship. <It's>...
That's not an urge I've ever experienced.
No? Oh, okay.
Well, thank you so much for your time and the beautiful music and for taking a few minutes to talk about it this afternoon.
Oh, what a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for the great questions.
Guy Mendolo, who'll bring the Guy Mendolo Ensemble to the Jaqua Concert Hall of the Shedd Institute in Eugene on Sunday, October 9th at 7:30 p.m. They will also be on the UO campus on Monday, October 10th for a noon appearance in Professor Monique Balbuena's class on Sephardic cultures and for a 6 p.m. lecture in Straub Hall called Myths, Lies, and Truths, The Reinvention of Ladino Song as Ancient. For more information, theshedd.org. GuyMendolo.com and uOregon.edu for an extended version of this interview, KLCC.org. For KLCC, I'm Eric Allen.